Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name's Andy Boyd. Today we're talking with Jill Richards about her book, The Fury Archives, Female Citizenship, Human Rights, and the International Avant-Gardes. Jill Richards, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. This is quite an arresting set of topics that you kind of lay out in the subtitle of your book, Female Citizenship, Human Rights, and the International Avant-Gardes. So what ties all these three things together?
Right. Originally, you know, academic subtitles are sort of annoying in that your publisher wants you to have all the keywords that could be searched for. But basically, I wanted to track the ways that developments in women's rights and female citizenship were happening apace with human rights. Before human rights became what we know it as today, as a sort of arm of the United Nations and multinational institutions. At this sort of earlier moment, I argue that human rights are a lot more plastic. They mean different things to different people and get appropriated as a kind of tactic for some early feminist movements. And it's interesting that in this early century moment, you also have avant-garde movements really imagining themselves as players in political action, for better or worse, right? Not necessarily having any purchase on political outcomes. And so it's this sort of welter of forces that I'm looking at as an archive in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was really interesting about your book is how you connect sort of first wave feminism with these very extreme avant-garde art movements such as Dada and Surrealism. And I feel like there's this perception that, you know, first wave feminism was sort of stodgy and middle class. But your book really pushes back pretty forcefully against that story. Was that a conscious goal of yours?
Yeah, I'm so irritated by the centennial of women's suffrage that, you know, it's like it seems like it's all about the vote and women in hats and sort of like these prim and proper women. And the feminist history that I'm interested in is all of the organizing and action that happened around the women's vote, but then didn't really necessarily end in the vote. So at the same time, we have these hunger strikes that are occurring for jailed women, you know, over months and months and months. So you have arson campaigns that are happening every week for sort of deserted churches in the countryside. And I'm more interested in those tactics and the kinds of social worlds that developed around those tactics, specifically that, you know, women who call themselves terrorists, who participated in bombings and acts of industrial sabotage at the same time the suffrage movement was happening. And I think that's a history that sometimes gets erased when we just focus on the end of the movement or the gain that was the women's vote.
Mm-hmm. In your acknowledgement section, you write a little bit about how this book kind of emerged for you and kind of in your thinking around the book around movements like Occupy Oakland, other leftist and anarchist groups that you've been involved with, which I think is sort of a really interesting perspective to be writing kind of scholarly history and literary analysis, you know, contra to Glenn Beck or whatever most academics are not politically radical.
Right. But
so how do you feel like your kind of involvement in on the ground political movements influenced the way that you looked at these historical radical sort of antecedents?
Well, it really changes what I look at for my archive, because when I started getting involved with these currents, there was a real gap between my experience on the ground, which was mostly about sitting through endless committee meetings or doing all the sort of nitty-gritty organizing to get a neighborhood kitchen set up, or you know, just sort of like the day-to-day experience of organizing, being super bored during an occupation because you're just there all day, right? Or super kind of bored and then excited during a march. These experiences aren't necessarily recorded in the histories or the newspaper accounts of the actions, which are all about the ends, or, you know, what did the march accomplish, especially in terms of changes in legislation. So I became really curious about how earlier currents on the left and amongst feminist and queer movements dealt with some of these more daily textural problems that were really sort of the center of my experience and others people's experience in Oakland during Occupy and during movements in the UC campuses. I wanted a prehistory, not so much so that we could find, you know, an answer like, what do you do in a certain scenario, but just for a kind of a company to understand how other formations had been working through similar things.
So to get more, a little more specific, could you give us some examples of some of the ways that kind of early radical feminism and avant-garde artistic movements were entangled with one another?
Yeah, for sure. I've been thinking, I was at a Breonna Taylor protest last night, and I've been thinking a lot about lists of names and the ways that social movements use the names of the dead as a kind of tactic or as a rallying cry. In New Haven, the names are particular to our location. And so along with Breonna Taylor, we hear about Stephanie Washington and Paul Witherspoon, who were shot in 2019 here. And so I wondered how earlier social movements sort of enumerated their dead, and then the ways that that gets taken up into artistic currents at the time. So one version of we have of this is a play called Fire's Daughters by Ina Cesaire. And it's about a kind of small insurrectionary movement in Martinique in the late 19th century. And the play begins with a list of names, the names of the insurrectionaries who were sentenced by the court. And it just lists name, profession, age, and that's it. It's this strange sort of omniscient voice that happens outside of the space of the play proper. And so one question I ask myself as a literary critic is sort of, how do we imagine the name doing work in that context, in the protest, in the play, in the archive? Who is the name speaking to? Is it someone that we identify with? Is it a kind of a lyric? Is it meant as a rallying cry for the future? And sort of thinking about the name and naming is one thing that connects this play that's, you know, supposedly happening in the late 19th century, was written in the 20th century, but whenever it gets enacted, sort of hinges upon the names that are familiar in our present day.
Great. One of the examples in your book that I found particularly interesting is that there's I forget the name of it, but there's like a early feminist like suffragette magazine that gets sort of rebranded as an avant-garde literary magazine that ends up publishing T.S. Eliot. And
right.
I found that really strange and interesting.
Right. It's a kind of forgotten prehistory of the egoist, which we usually think of as a kind of stodgy magazine. And a magazine for like the great white men of modernism, primarily. But actually, you know, it was so weird and so much more radical in its sort of earlier feminist guise. And so, you know, it's it's life trajectories of print cultures like that that I often turn to show that the feminist movements that I'm interested in or the political formations I'm interested in weren't really like that far off or that peripheral to the modernism we're probably most familiar with, that is like T.S. Eliot or Ezra Pound.
Yeah, that's another one of the sort of theoretical claims of your book that I found really interesting, is that I feel like there's this other sort of commonly received story that is the modernist movement was aesthetically revolutionary but politically reactionary.
Right.
And you want to sort of say, well, sure, I mean, like you're not trying to argue that Ezra Pound wasn't a fascist.
Right.
But
right.
You are saying, but he's not the whole story. T.S. Eliot and Yeats and, you know, Joyce are not the whole story. And if you widen your sort of lens on modernism, it starts to encompass a lot of people who are very clearly on the left and even the radical left.
Right, right. And sometimes those figures on the radical left then turn right, you know? It's a really knotty history, too. It's not like I used to get really frustrated doing the legal history that the super left radical anti-colonial black writers that I was interested in didn't just always stay on their side, you know, in terms of a radical potential or a revolutionary current. They're often engaged with or appropriating or borrowing the language from both liberal and far right currents. And so when you get deep into the archive or the literary and dramatic pieces from the period, it's not so easy to always draw divisions. And so a lot of what I'm interested in is just dwelling in the political or ethical ambiguities of these artworks.
Yeah, one of the figures who occupies a lot of space in your book, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing their name correctly, is Claude Cahun. Is that it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who's on the cover of your book mm-hmm. wearing a shirt that I very much want, which says, "I am in training, don't kiss me."
Yeah.
with sort of some, like, I don't know, I got it, nipple tassels is what they look like on the shirt.
Yeah.
Or pasties mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah, and, pasties, but they're part of the shirt.
They're part of the shirt, yeah. And they're wearing these sort of heart-shaped, blush makeup mm-hmm. Splotches and this kind of Cupid's bow lipstick. So this is a style of femininity that seems like it has a lot in common with like contemporary drag performance,
right.
Like this sort of like mm-hmm. sort of burlesque of femininity, mm-hmm. Kind of pushing it to this extreme degree. Is that what's going on in Claude's work, or is it a little more complicated?
I mean, it is complicated, but I think you are right on the nose. Like Claude Cahun, I mean, was a really kind of forgotten figure for a long time, and I think there's been a resurgence of interest in her. And I'm just going to use female pronouns because that's what she used. But it's a vexed issue because Cahun has become a kind of precursor to transgender identities in the present. And so some would argue that we should use they, them. And this sort of historical, I'll say naughtiness again, is part of what makes Cahun so interesting, because she was dressing this way so much earlier than a lot of what we understand trans or even burlesque identity or butch femme identity to sort of have come into prominence. It's actually, I think, one of the most interesting takes on Cahun's portraits are the ways that they are actually a kind of a participatory work with her partner, a life partner. So Cahun is behind the camera, but the person we don't see is Marcel Moore, who's taking the picture. Most of the pictures, there's hundreds of them, weren't even meant to be circulated. They were just sort of like this like intimate currency, a reworking of identities. Cahun gets compared to Cindy Sherman a lot. But Cindy Sherman is creating photographs as works of art to be shown in a museum. Whereas with Cahun, it's unclear what the purpose of the art object was in many cases. It might have just been a kind of hobby, a kind of intimate conversation. it could have been, you know, like part of what Cahoon and Marcellus Moore's sort of journaling or, you know, a personal history project looked like. And so the status as art or performance is a little bit vexed.
Yeah. You also talk a bit about Claude and Marcel's work as sort of anti-fascist pranksters.
I don't know
if that's the term, but they're you know, you start with this sort of very august, austere claim that they were, you know, part of the underground resistance to the Nazis. And then when you talk about what their specific activities entailed, it starts to look, you know, not quite like the bombing train lines or something that we might expect from film. So could you describe a bit about what their anti-fascism looked like?
Yeah. Well, you know, they got very serious punishments for their crimes. They were jailed by the Gestapo and sentenced to death. So that's, you know, they did.
And they were sort of rescued by the British.
Who
they were on the island of Jersey, which I didn't realize was very close to France.
It's just a tiny little speck in the channel.
Yeah. So, and it was taken over by the Nazis and then, you know, thankfully liberated by the British before the executions were carried out.
Right.
But yeah, what were the crimes that they were going to be executed for?
When you hear those punishments, right, you know, sentenced to jail, sentenced to life, you imagine train bombings and serious spying. But actually what they did was, it was more like a propaganda campaign where they left little pieces of paper or drawings or artworks that were meant to convince German soldiers to join the other side or to just irritate them sometimes. And so it was this weird kind of surrealist practice of leaving art objects, sayings, little sort of quotations and so on, where they could be found by other people in the island of Jersey. And then sometimes they did like these like weird little, I guess I'd call them like object collages with panthers and so on, or they used nail polish. It was very whimsical and I think probably not terribly effective. But nevertheless, I guess a brave thing to be doing at a moment where I'm not sure what other options for resistance were available in the island of Jersey. So,
I mean, do you think being effective was the point, or was it a more private kind of rebellion of the soul almost, kind of proving to themselves that they were not cowed by the Nazis? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they took themselves pretty seriously if you read the letters and the prison writings. So when I assume that they knew that they weren't that effective, but then you read the writing and you're like, oh, okay, they really thought that this was both like a very serious moral prerogative. I don't know, it's hard to gauge the humor because a lot of the writing comes after they were sentenced and then everything took on a different light. I think that some of it is an attempt to create some levity or a sense of humor around sort of extremely violent, inhumane conditions. And remember that Cahoon was Jewish and so was in a really dangerous position, both as a Jew and as a queer woman or a woman living with another woman during this time. So, and, you know, in both cases, for Moore and Cahoon, their very existence was already a kind of feat of survival.
Yeah, and Claude had some theoretical writing about the kind of the relationship between art and resistance, right? Could you sketch out a little bit of kind of what her theoretical approach was in this area?
Yeah, I mean, she started with the Surrealist movement in France and then got kind of cheesed off with Breton's misogyny and, you know, the sort of clubby atmosphere and really stopped believing, I think, in some ways that art could affect political change. So like the Bretonian line that, you know, an art in the service of the revolution was starting to wear thin, I think, around the World War II. All the same, I think Cahoon doesn't, if you read across the writings, there's some shifts, but it's never entirely coherent. I think it's the desire that artwork can affect the world never really goes away. There's still a kind of longing that art objects, and poetry in particular, Cahoon wrote a lot of really incredible poetry, this kind of desire that it could affect some kind of social change is present throughout.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Going back to the sort of feminist movement, one of the things that surprised me about the book was how you reveal that feminism and socialism and anarchism were very closely aligned during this time. I feel like we often have this idea that, you know, early 20th century socialists only cared about the sort of masculinist idea of the factory worker. But It seems like that's another, again, I feel like we keep coming back to this theme of these kind of received narratives that your book is kind of complicating. And this seems like one of them as well. So how would you describe the relationship between the socialist movement and the feminist movement at this time?
Oh, it's super messy and super intertwined. You know, a lot of especially left feminists were a huge part of the socialist movement, but they didn't always agree. And so I almost like to tell the story by episodes, because it starts to show the ways that these two currents come together and then they come apart, and they come together and they come apart. So one of my favorites is the proletarian birth strike, which was a tactic imagined by feminists in the late 19th and early 20th century. The idea is you wouldn't stop having sex. It's just you would start using birth control, which was then a potentially scandalous thing. And the birth control would sort of drastically lower the birth rate. And then capitalism would fall, because there wouldn't be a sort of new generation of men and women to work in the factories. And so that was the idea behind the proletarian birth strike. And feminists were really for it, in part because it valorized or allowed the use of birth control. But, you know, the socialists and even, you know, sort of very prominent socialist feminists thought it was just total claptrap, in part because they didn't want to take any emphasis away from the situation of the factory worker and sort of worry about these concerns about childbirth. And so a lot of times you'll get this narrative where socialists say, like, yes, feminism is important, but it's not our priority. It's the thing that we'll worry about after the revolution, after we have a sort of worker strike, and then we have a new society, then we can look at feminists' ambitions. And what I'm interested in is the response by feminists, who say, no, we need to, you know, we want a revolution, but we need to meet our demands right now, rather than waiting for a better future.
Yeah, this idea of the proletarian birth strike, it never entirely went away. It reminds me of Donna Haraway recently has got into quite a bit of controversy on the left for kind of imagining a future with a drastically smaller global population, now for more ecological reasons. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of pushback against those arguments because of the history of eugenics,
yes.
Right? Like, because of the idea that, like, you know, you can say it's voluntary, but it's still, it's hard. There's an uneasy kind of slippage between that argument to, you know, like Margaret Sanger's arguments about how poverty is caused by overpopulation,
yes.
Which are ickier.
Yeah.
So was that kind of part of the controversy at the time in the early 20th century around the proletarian birth strike, the idea that this could kind of feed into eugenic ideas about the inferiority of working class people?
Well, it's a problem for me now. I certainly wouldn't advocate a proletarian birth strike now. I see it when it was happening earlier, the eugenic tie was seen as one of its strengths. And this is at a moment when early socialists and anarchists were also eugenicists. And so this idea of controlling the population for a better future was much more accepted then, which does not make it less problematic now. A lot of times, these eugenic and socialist feminists are sort of asking for a quite horrible trade-off. And we see this with Margaret Sanger as well, as she moves from a kind of left feminist position to an increasingly eugenicist, racist politics. And so I'm less in the position of advocating or not, and more in the position of trying to understand, like, why would this seem appealing for a group of women organizing at this time? And how can it all, you know, sort of expand our ideas about reproductive freedoms, which right now are sort of problematically tied to the right to privacy? And the privacy doctrine is extremely limited. And so what happens if we start to think about reproduction as a tactic for equality, like, the birth strike is a tactic? What other tactics could we sort of imagine in that arsenal besides privacy? These are the questions that are sort of spinning in my head when I look back to the extremely weird and, yes, eugenic history of the proletarian birth strike.
Right, because it's not about this is a private decision between you and your doctor. It's about this is a tactic in the struggle for, you know, human liberation.
Right. And it's not even my body, my choice, right? It's like this imagination of collective bodies and your body and other bodies being kind of literally tools or weapons in the service of overthrowing capitalism. It makes me think of actually the Mother's Brigade in Portland, or the ways that unwaged women, or then I think there was a husband's brigade too, or fathers, I should say fathers. But the ways that these familial roles get weaponized as possible political subjects is something that's still happening or still thought about today.
And it seems like, I mean, we're getting a little bit afield here, but it seems like part of the political efficacy of kind of weaponizing your role as a mother is that a mother is imagined to be in a political standpoint. So for like the example of like the Mothers of the Disappeared in Argentina, like part of what they were able to do is say, no, we're not leftists, we're not dissidents, we're just mothers who want to know where our sons are. When that was like clearly sort of a pose, right?
Right. Well, it also shifts a sort of familiar socialist framework where to be an effective political body, you need a wage so that you can strike, right? Mothers are not seen as waged workers. They're not seen within the framework of the worker's identity. And so they are not seen as having political leverage because their labor is unwaged, is unrecognized. And so by taking the role of mother seriously as a worker, right, as someone who contributes to social wealth and as someone with a political purchase, I think, you know, it's a really interesting standpoint. And if you start to look backwards, you see mothers doing this all over the globe and all sort of in different across historical moments.
How sort of elaborate was the theoretical framework around this birth strike? Like, was there anything like a sort of reproductive, feminist socialist theoretical analysis, or was it seen as a tactic? I guess that's my question. Was it seen as a tactic, or was it seen as a sort of theoretical challenge to the way that the socialist movement conceived of work?
You mostly find it as a tactic in manuals. So in Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's manual, Sabotage, it's like a how-to manual, right? And she tells workers, all right, well, if you can't strike, you can destroy the looms in your factory this way. and that's sabotage. And then at the end, she has a discussion of the birth strike as a kind of sabotage of the population. And so you see it in places like that, in leaflets. And then sometimes it's in sort of the notes from workers' meetings. I don't think it was ever taken that seriously as a tool to destroy capitalism. I think it was taken more seriously as a way to popularize birth control, really, and sort of recognize women's labor in the home as unwaged, but nevertheless important and limited.
Yeah. Another moment you look at is the We Charge Genocide petition. And I first learned about the We Charge Genocide petition from Shauna Redmond's book on Paul Robeson. But what I didn't realize was how recent the term genocide was at the time.
Yeah.
So it was really a time when kind of there wasn't a super elaborate popular understanding of what did and didn't count as genocide. So how does this petition fit into your larger argument about the evolution of human rights and the relationship between human rights and avant-garde artistic movements?
Right. Well, I look at We Charge Genocide as another enumeration of names, actually. And so I, as a literary critic, I sort of come to it as an object that isn't literary, but still offers itself to a kind of problematic analysis. It's almost impossible to read. It's 250 pages, and it's just sort of iterative depictions of lynching, one after another after another. And you start to read them, and they start to blur together. And then these weird patterns emerge. So you're like, oh, wait, is this the same one? No, it's a different one. And it's just this sort of horrible, incredibly grotesque experience of a reader coming to an incredibly long document of suffering. And so I try to understand what that looks like, but also try to understand it within a reproductive politics or a feminist politics. Along the lines of the birth strike, but quite different here, in that genocide as a crime is about the destruction of a population. And so here we have a population of Black youth that are being murdered. And one of the claims is that it is therefore a crime not under the sovereignty of the state or the United States, but up to the jurisdiction of the United Nations.
Did this reflect a sort of genuine faith on the part of the people who presented this petition in the ability of the United Nations to intervene in U.S. domestic affairs? Or was it more of a sort of, and I don't use this word negatively, was it sort of a propaganda tactic?
Right. I think it was maybe more of a tactic meant to embarrass the United States. And they were embarrassed. So if you look at U.N. negotiations during this time, Russia is constantly pointing to the United States' poor human rights record through lynching and crimes against African Americans as a reason why the United States should not be respected on the international stage. And so they're playing into this debate, but it's a pretty powerful hand because the legitimacy of the United States on the foreign stage is the thing that's at stake.
One of the other things that you write about in the context of the United Nations are these committee meetings, especially around the drafting of the Declaration on Human Rights, where you see the sort of predictable back and forth between the United States and sort of its allies and the Soviet Union. But you also see, you know, what we might think of as the Third World or the non-aligned countries finding ways kind of in the cracks between those two giant edifices to make their claims heard. So could you discuss a little bit about kind of how those less powerful nations used the structure of these UN committees to get their voices heard?
Right. I wanted to move away from understanding the committee meeting as a kind of democratic public forum where everybody's voices can be heard. Because anyone who works in an institution and has sat through many committee meetings knows that it's not necessarily a space of freedom. And I wanted to think about the process of committee meetings as a social form, and something that deserves attention. So not just in terms of who talks and for how long and how loud and that sort of thing, but also how sort of smaller players or other voices might get into the mix. And the weird thing about the United Nations drafting in San Francisco is the ways that what were sometimes called the smaller nations would like corner people in the bathroom to talk to them outside of the context of the meeting. Or develop sort of little factions within the meetings, or in one case, I do this long reading of a moment that's just purely procedural in the committee meeting. It doesn't affect any kind of change, but it's where the delegate from Haiti just sort of monologues and imagines a different sort of world, and then immediately gets shot down by Henry Shawcross, the delegate from Great Britain. and this imagining goes nowhere, but it's itself a sort of interesting moment of utopian thinking that is then just like buried in the pages and pages and pages of meeting minutes for these organizations. And so I kind of wanted to position the committee meeting not as a conservative form or a liberal form, but just a form that could be used towards any ends. And in that chapter, I switch over from the sort of UN committee meeting to a sort of Black feminist organizing in Martinique that was associated with the UN at the same time, who put, you know, give us a very different use and practice and ends for committee work.
Right. And I found that juxtaposition really interesting because on the one hand, this is a group that is, you know, very much kind of at the margins of global politics, pushing back against colonialism, but is also sort of, I don't know, liberal. Like they're not particularly politically radical.
Not at all.
Even while they are this sort of like, you know, Black anti-colonialist formation. So could you talk a little bit more about, I mean, that's one of the, you know, maybe more surprising entanglements between different kind of political tendencies that you write about in the book.
Right. It's about Paulette Nardal, who became a representative for the United Nations and was also involved in Negritude currents in Martinique. And so she seems like this kind of perfect juncture, a figure that is involved in international politics, but also involved in the kind of radical poetic currents. But she's actually not very radical at all. She is liberal to conservative. And her writing is usually about a kind of racialized progress narrative of colonial subjects becoming Catholic. She was Catholic. And sort of achieving enlightenment. And so, you know, as a critic, what do you do with that? I want to give her recognition as a Black feminist Negritude writer. I want her to be part of that record. But then I get kind of frustrated with her sort of matriarchal narratives of Martinican feminism. So what I end up doing, actually, I look at the journal that she was a part of. It's called Woman in the City. And I look at some of the editorials, and they're just, you know, they're often about, you know, sort of Martinican women gaining the vote and participating in the United Nations. But more interesting than that are the meeting minutes from their society. And so it's sort of reading around the corners of the magazine, reading these meeting minutes about the different kinds of committees that were getting formed and the ideas they had about mutual aid that becomes most interesting. And so they're imagining an all-women's police force to take over the current police force, which is like, okay, more police. But then they're also imagining different ways of sharing child-rearing labor, of establishing societies to walk women home at night, of having kind of communal kitchens. And so that is actually the kinds of conversation and practice that I end up being most excited about and most wanting to sort of understand as part of an overlooked Black feminist history of Negritude.
Mm-hmm. And this also seems to intersect with debates about kind of mutual aid and is mutual aid inherently radical or revolutionary, or can mutual aid just be a way of sort of patching the holes in the existing system without seriously challenging it? Do you see your work intersecting in those debates?
Right, I do. And I've been thinking a lot about care work in general during COVID times and what that means. And I think, it's hard to not imagine unpaid labors of child rearing, of cooking and cleaning, this kind of feminist reproductive politics as not being part of any kind of revolutionary program. And so when people say that, these labors are peripheral or not important, I think that's just a way to erase the labor of women more generally, or the necessity of survival, especially for Black and Brown people during a potentially revolutionary moment. One book I keep coming back to is this, it's in my afterword. It's this very crazy book called The Hearing Trumpet by Leonora Carrington. And it's about a bunch of sort of octogenarian ladies who get sent away to an elder care facility that turns out to be full of witches. And so all of these ladies in their 80s and 90s who have been rejected by their families and seen as like past the point of reproductivity, past the point of usefulness, are now in a kind of witchy commune. And they band together and survive the end of the world. It's a very strange book, and the plot doesn't entirely make sense. But it's weird in the canon of modernist studies because we almost never get narratives of older women in particular, and rarely get narratives that are so sternly focused on labors of care and the necessity of feeding yourself and others, of taking care of the health and others as part of what we need to survive both the end of the world and to maintain any kind of radical political practice.
Yeah, and Carrington's a figure who's been sort of taken up recently by kind of contemporary feminists. I feel like she feels very of the moment now with the sort of witchiness and the fact that she's a surrealist. And like, I have a friend who's a trans autistic playwright who is absolutely obsessed with Leonora Carrington.
Aww.
But you sort of have reservations about this novel. You think it's not particularly a great novel. Is that, reading you correctly there?
I mean,
it's always hard to write. I mean, I really get the sense in your book that you're not the kind of critic who loves writing a harsh account of a book, but
yes,
it seems like you felt like you had to here.
I try to be generous, and I'm really torn because on one hand, The Hearing Trumpet seems like it would be my favorite book in the world. It has everything I'm interested in. It's got witches, it has transgender subjects, it has sort of multiracial sociality, the end of the world. It has like these animal-human hybrids, and it's all about care work. I mean, it's just like, I feel like it was written for me. At the same time, it's kind of boring. reading it, it's like listening to someone narrate their dream at length, where they're just like, and then I climbed a mountain, and then I met a dog, and then we descended into a pit, and then there was a train, like nothing adds up, and it just sort of, you just feel kind of lost after a while. And then I think also I sometimes feel put off by Carrington's sense of humor, which some people find really charming. I think that she's given up on the idea that aesthetic experiments can have any kind of purchase on the world. And so it becomes this point of ironic, sad commentary in her work. Mm-hmm. I say like it sort of feels like a museum for past revolutionary forms. It's like a very echoey. And sometimes, I mean, I think I would probably feel that way too, but it's not necessarily the book that I feel most passionate about or the most enlivened by.
Yeah. Do you think that art can change the world?
No. I think, no, but I work on a lot of really earlier works that thought that was the case. And I think that I am sometimes persuaded by the romance of that imagination. But do I think it can happen? No, not at all.
Why not?
I think that artworks can change the person who makes them and the person who reads them. But if I say, like, write a poem about homelessness tomorrow, that might change me, right? It might change how I think about homelessness. I don't think it will necessarily materially affect the people who don't have housing security where I live in New Haven. And so there are instances where art objects have blown up and affected, you know, great material change. They're just so far and few between that I sometimes feel very skeptical about making that particular trajectory a banner for what art can do.
Right. So how do you see your kind of, life's work then? As somebody who is politically radical, who wants to see fundamental change in the world, and who is a sort of credentialed literary critic.
I know.
You know, where does that leave you, if that's not too personal of a question?
Not at all. I ask myself this all the time. Because, you know, then why read poems? Why read novels? Why am I going to plays? Like, what's the point? And I do think that these aesthetic works allow for imaginations that can be, on one hand, maybe most basically a kind of coping mechanism. I think I would not have survived adolescence without novels. But also a kind of imagination for futures, for different modes of sociality, for tactics, for different paths, for history in the world. I think that's important. I just don't think that they necessarily will affect those changes. I think they could be a kind of seed for them. They could allow for imagination, but I don't see the artwork doing things. I think people do things.
Right. I wonder if this is a sort of a feminist claim in a way that's kind of connected to what we were discussing earlier, in that, you know, it's maybe a sort of, I mean, I'm really just kind of spitballing here, but like, it's maybe a sort of masculinist idea of politics, that politics equals change. Whereas if we look at a more kind of social reproductive approach to politics, we might think that the work of kind of maintaining people and maintaining life and making life worth living is itself a political act, even if the goal isn't change. So do you think there's a way that we can think of art as a form of social reproduction in that way?
Yeah, as a form of survival. I think that's mm-hmm. absolutely true. And in that case, some of the emphasis is taken away from the individual art producer and put on the consumer, right? Or the person who is reading or writing, or I'm really interested in amateur art and in whether it is in prisoner writing, in prison productions of visual art, in children's, you know, drawing. I think, you know, everyone should be an artist and everyone should be able to make art. And that might be the most radical vision of the ways that the aesthetic and the political can be conjoined. I'm thinking of, you know, like chalk writing during protests and poster making and reading groups. I think like the most sustaining radical practice in my life might be consistently belonging to reading groups, to have, to make friends and comrades and intimates and people that then become part of my mutual aid circle by sharing our interests in literary and theoretical texts.
Can I ask what you're reading in your reading group?
Let's see, I'm about to join a new disability studies reading group. So I haven't started that one, but I will be talking later this month with my Ferrante reading group. So that's a group based on the novels of Elena Ferrante. I haven't read her most recent one, but I'm just delighted. It becomes an excuse for me to stay in touch with people that I haven't spoken to for a long time and to sort of reach out.
I'm in a socialist reading group, and tomorrow we're having our discussion of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Blithedale Romance,
which was my
suggestion, and I'm very anxious about it because I'm not sure anyone's going to like it.
Oh, are you leading the discussion?
Yeah, I am.
And so for you, what is the socialist import of The Blithedale Romance?
Well, I mean, it's about a socialist commune, for one. But I also think it's sort of about, it's about the ways that these, communities emerge at a specific time in a specific movement that maybe don't change the world, but do change everybody involved in the movement, and therefore change the world if in a much more modest way than the people had originally intended. And I feel like that's definitely something that I see in your book, is that, do we know that Claude Cahun's anti-Nazi pranks hastened the liberation of Jersey? They probably didn't, but we're still talking about them now, 70 years later, and that's kind of special.
Exactly. And then Cahun was also part of this circle of queer artists in Paris and Jersey, and that sort of just that work of sustaining each other and writing to each other. Is something to be celebrated and thought through as well, different forms of minoritarian community, I think, as well as sort of like this huge global scope of fighting the Nazis. I'm tired of fighting the Nazis being the sort of standard version of historical action and change that is endlessly repeated to us in the movies or in the novels. Like, I'm much more interested in a tiny, secret queer society on the Isle of Jersey and the ways that they could sustain each other in a time of war.
Well, Jill Richards, I've taken up a lot of your time already, but thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts, and thanks for your wonderful book, The Fury Archives.
Well, thank you.